work in Brazil. Since we've had the opportunity over the years to visit here fairly often, talk about some things, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on all the background information, but I will go into a little bit of that because I'm sure there's some people here that maybe have not been able to have the bigger context of what's gone on in the last 18 or 19 years. But I want to spend most of the time on the current status of the work, kind of showing what's been happening in recent years in our work down in Brazil. And, of course, a little bit about some of the challenges and plans that we have. So I think that'll take up the 35 minutes or so that we have here this morning to go through these things. As far as background information, very briefly, most of you are aware that Brazil is a pretty big place, bigger than the 48 continental states, and with about 200 million people scattered throughout that, most of them along the seaboard. We have been involved living in Brazil since 1993. First trips that we made down a couple of years before that, getting ready for the move to Brazil. But my family moved there in 93 along with several others, and my family has stayed there throughout this time. It'll be 19 years on August 10th, if the Lord gives us that time to continue a few more months. We live and work in the city of São Paulo, a metropolitan area of close to 20 million down in the southern part of the country, about an hour and a half inland from the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. During the last few years, and this will be a lot of what I'll emphasize this morning, we've been traveling a lot more. Once the kids grew up and we were able to have a little bit more freedom to go out to other places, because there are so many contacts from all over the country, we've been trying to get out and give opportunities for people to participate in studies and sometimes to go specifically to see some of those contacts in other parts of the country. Over these last 19 years, the work has also involved a number of other North Americans who have been there. Several of them are people that you know. Several of them have had connections with this area. Greg Chandler, Alan Dvorak, Gary Fisher, Mike Bozeman, Greg Gravett, Tim Richter, several others have been down there and have helped in different ways. Several have lived there for a couple of years or more during these last 18 years. And, of course, much of the work, as in any place, depends on those who live there. And so it has become more and more obvious the role of Brazilians in the work that's being done. And I certainly pray that that will continue to be the case. I want to touch briefly on some of the sources of contacts that we get in Brazil. I realize this is not going to make a whole lot of sense to many of you, but it's just an example of one of the things we use to try to get people to look at our website where we offer a number of Bible studies. But as far as the way we see contacts, it's not all that different in Brazil than I think anywhere else, although there may be greater emphasis or effectiveness of one thing or another. Many of our best contacts are personal contacts, and especially new converts who during their first year or two after they're converted have opportunities to try to get to as many of their family members, relatives, co-workers, neighbors as possible. Naturally, what happens is that those contacts start to dry up after a while, that people have already had an opportunity. So we leave the door open, but we have to move on to find other contacts as well. But we've had some people who have done extremely well in using those personal contacts. I've had some situations like this one in Alagoas or this next one in Manaus where somebody said they wanted to invite some people over for a study at their house when I was going to be visiting that city. And in some cases, it's 35 or 40 or more people that are there for the study. In this case, the fellow who's standing back in the back here had been converted just a few months before I went back to visit again in that city. And he wanted to invite some people over and had more than 40 people come to a study at 9 o'clock at night at his house. And this man, Vanderlei, has turned out to be extremely effective at getting out and inviting people, getting people to come to studies. Besides the personal contacts, we have used, and the congregation here has helped greatly in over the years in our work with printed material. I'm going to show where there's a natural shift occurring to greater and greater emphasis on the Internet, but at the same time, printed material still has a very valuable role in that. Maybe not as important a role as it did 18 years ago because of the access that people have to the Internet, but it still enables us to get material into the hands of people that don't use the Internet or that don't have easy access to the Internet. Not everybody has broadband access to be able to download volumes of material. In the last several months, we've had another opportunity to work with newspaper articles. A man who was converted down in the southern part of the country last year runs an auto repair shop and knows a lot of the people in his town, including some of the editors of a local newspaper. So he pitched the idea of a column called What Does the Bible Say? And they agreed to that. And so for about 7 months now, I've been writing two articles that run the full length of a tabloid size sheet of paper in that newspaper. It goes out to about 40 small towns in the northern part of Rio Grande do Sul. I'm not going to try to say it in English. Just leave it the way it is. But which is the southernmost state of Brazil. Something about 12,000 or so total circulation. But it's a free opportunity to get that material out to that many people on a regular basis, in addition to the other materials that we print ourselves. The Internet has continued to be and has grown considerably as far as its effectiveness as a tool. The website that we're running that Carl Henneke has been doing since the mid-1990s, early on I remember that we had put that website out there. It had been on running for a few weeks. Few people used the Internet at that point. And I remember after a few weeks being real excited that we'd had 1,000 people visit the website. These days, that takes about an hour and a half to happen. We have an average of about 20,000 visits per day coming into that website. Now, a lot of those are people that come and go. But there are some who stay and stay quite a bit. And one of the things that's helped to draw some of that attention in the last year and a half is that we've been working also with videos that we're putting on our website. We're putting them on YouTube. I'm sure many of you are familiar with what YouTube is. We're putting them on YouTube, but then embedding them in our website. When people go to our website to see them, they don't see all the extra advertising and links to other videos. But at the same time, they can come through a Google search, and they might end up finding them on YouTube. And on every one of the videos, we put a link to our site that they're able to go on from that. As we embed them on our website, we're able to get rid of all that extraneous material, and they're able to see just the specific videos that they want to look at so that they can go into those. But as you notice, an example here, on all of the videos, we leave visible the link to our website throughout the video. So even if somebody else picks it up and puts it on their website, it helps to bring contacts back to our website to see other teaching. We've been getting recently about 1,000 views a day on those videos. An average of about 30,000 a month. And it's been amazing to me how effective that has been. Perhaps partly because we deal with a society that does not have a good educational system. Reading comprehension is not the strong point for many Brazilians. There are some people that just don't read at all. And so the video format has been able to reach some people that we probably would not have reached very effectively by the written material that we've been using. We also have been using video conferences, a means of doing a long-distance Bible class or sermon, but that allows an opportunity for people to stay afterwards in the room, in this virtual conference room, and ask questions and participate in a question-and-answer session with that. This has also been a way of helping with some teaching of very small congregations that are scattered around, or even isolated Christians in situations where they're not able to meet together with other Christians. One of the cases that's been interesting about this was a case of two women who were converted in Belgium, the two Brazilians. One of them got in touch with us through our website. I was able to get them in touch with brethren in Amsterdam. These two women, roommates, were baptized, one and then later the other. But they were going from Belgium over to Amsterdam to participate with brethren to worship near Amsterdam. And the problem is the worship there was done in Dutch and English. They speak Portuguese, and one of them speaks some English. So she was often trying to translate things for her friend who was beside her to understand what was going on. So the brethren there got in touch with us, and we worked out an arrangement that they do all of their worship services in Dutch and English. But when it comes time for preaching, most of the members stay there for the sermon, while the Brazilians would go off into another room and watch a sermon through video conference in Portuguese. They decided that would be more edifying for them than trying to understand a few words out of a sermon in a language they don't speak. It's not ideal, but it's something to try to help people in a situation like that. It took me quite a while to get involved with Facebook. There's a lot of garbage on Facebook, a lot of wasted time. However, it does serve as a means of encouraging people to look at some of the Bible studies that we post, as well as encouraging contact between brethren. And I think that's been especially helpful for some of those who are somewhat isolated in different places. Every time I've come back in recent years, I've commented about the public studies that we've been doing. Since about 2006, especially, that I've been traveling more extensively. And we've been doing studies in different parts of the country. We've done these now in every region of Brazil and in most states. And in some places, we've gone back several times and done series like this. Just a few characteristics. We do these studies almost always in neutral locations. By that, I mean a place that's not directly connected with any church. It'll be a schoolroom or a conference room at a hotel or at a civic center, some place that people can just come for a Bible study. Normally, we do them in the format of what we refer to as study marathons. This is a matter of cost effectiveness. Rather than renting a place 6 nights for an hour a night, we rent it one day for 6 hours straight. And we do studies either from 10 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon with an hour lunch break in the middle, or from 2 in the afternoon until 9 o'clock with an hour break for people to go get something to eat. And normally, we'll have people who will come and will be there on time for the first study and will stay through the entire marathon. We will keep those going, moving with the same theme normally, quite a bit of material packed into that, usually pretty hard-hitting lessons to try to get directly to some of the most important questions. We always allow opportunities for question and answer sessions, which often open up into a kind of a debate forum, informal, but sometimes people contesting things that have been taught. And those are often some of our very best opportunities. I don't remember the sequence on things, so I may have told you all about this case the last time I was here, but there was a situation a couple or 3 years ago where I was teaching in a city. I'd gone there several times. There had been a couple of people converted there, and we were hoping to find others as we kept going back and doing more studies in the city. And after several times, one night, on a Wednesday night, I was teaching about plan of salvation, and a very well-mannered, courteous, elderly Baptist gentleman who had been there for other studies, had made some good comments in other studies, stood up at the end of it and disagreed with everything I had taught. He disagreed about the necessity of baptism for the remission of sins, and he made his arguments against that, and I let him present his arguments. And I responded to him, and he then came back with another round of arguments. I let him talk again, responded to him again, and then I looked to the audience and said to them, you all are going to have to sort this out, because we're obviously, we can't both be saying the truth. At least one of us is distorting the truth. Maybe we're both wrong, but one of us is definitely wrong. 4 days later, 14 people were baptized in that town, and there are now three congregations meeting in that small state of Sergipe, where just a few years ago we were not aware of any groups meeting to following according to the biblical pattern. We announce these studies through our website. We hand a lot of flyers, either going door to door or going to public street corners where we're allowed to hand them out in some cities. There's one little congregation up in Manaus of about 20 people. Last year, those brethren handed out more than 100,000 flyers in their own city and other cities. Some of them traveled to other states to help with studies that were being done in those places and handing out flyers. What do we teach in these studies? In the early series of studies that I did, starting about 2006, we covered a lot of different topics. We talked about the nature of God, the nature of the church, some textual studies. We went through the book of Hebrews, topics out of Joshua, different things of that sort. And, of course, in those we're able to get to a lot of different topics that need to be touched upon. But it became obvious the questions that kept coming up is we would have people in these studies from a variety of different denominational backgrounds, some who had virtually no Bible knowledge at all. So last year, I put together a series of some of the questions that were coming up most frequently. We put it as 10 questions that need to be asked in the churches today. And we tried during this series, again doing it in a marathon format, 6.5 hours of study in one day, to very directly approach some of the most significant controversial issues in the religious world today. Since we deal with a lot of Pentecostals, we dealt with Holy Spirit baptism, with spiritual gifts. Since we deal with many people that do not believe in what the Bible teaches about salvation, we dealt with what the Scriptures teach about that, talked about the role of women, talked about the deity of Christ, packed all of these things and several other topics into a single day of very intensive study. Result of that was that there were several conversions. There were some new congregations started, and I'll show a little bit about that in a few minutes. But at the same time, this left a necessity that we're trying to address better this year. To illustrate it, I have a friend who several years ago wanted to build a house in his own neighborhood, but there was not a vacant lot available to buy. So he bought a couple of side-by-side lots with a couple of old dilapidated houses on them, tore the houses down. But he didn't move his family onto those lots right after he tore the houses down. First, he had to build another house. And in effect, what we did last year in addressing these controversial topics was to tear down an old house, to try to demolish the false ideas and the false doctrines. But it's not sufficient for somebody to say, you know, what they're doing is wrong, or even what I was doing is wrong. You have to build something on that. We're not going to please the Lord just by deciding that we were wrong about other things. We have to do what He wants. And so this year, I've started going back to many of the same places. Now, in some situations, working with young congregations that were begun. And this year, the emphasis is on the Sermon on the Mount. Again, in a six-hour marathon format to go through Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It's not the most thorough study in the world of the Sermon on the Mount, but it does give opportunity to focus on the question of building our character and in seeking to be disciples of the Lord. It's been well received, and I think is a needed balance to what we looked at last year. What I want to do in this next section is kind of show a geographic and historical progression. Geographically, I'm going to use a map of Brazil here. I'm going to keep updating as we move down through this. I want to take this in three-year increments and to try to give you an idea of what has been happening since we moved there in 1993. The congregations I'm going to be referring to here are congregations we work with, that we have contact with. I'm not trying to establish some official list of what churches are sound or not. I'm talking about groups that we work with and that receive us in the work that we're doing there. And so anybody wants to talk to me further about that part of it later, happy to do that. In 1993, we went to São Paulo, moved there. By the end of that year, one congregation had been started. We also made some efforts to work with some existing churches of Christ that were there, and for a while had some opportunities with some of those groups. By 93, these are some of the ones in that initial group that were there in 1993. By 90, I'm suspecting that Greg Chandler took that picture because he's not in it, but he would have been there the time that was done. By 1996, we had seen some further development in and around São Paulo. A congregation in Colônia in São Paulo, Greater São Paulo, had begun. A congregation had begun in Guarapiranga, also in São Paulo. And in up about a two-hour drive from São Paulo, a congregation in Indaiatuba and another one in Mogi Mirim. All those groups continue to meet in those different places. By 1999, the spread was going a little bit farther out in a couple of different directions. There was a congregation in Floresta, which is over in the western side of the state of São Paulo. São Paulo is a big state. To give a general idea as you look at these state divisions, remember I mentioned this is more land area than the 48 states here, but divided into 26 states. So on average, the states in Brazil are about twice the size of American states. Also, by the end of 98, there was a congregation begun in Jequié. Some of you know Greg Gravett. That's where Greg lived for the time that he was in Brazil, working with the brethren in Jequié. By 2002, well, these are just pictures. These were some of the brethren in Jequié early on. By 2002, there had been some further work done with starting a new congregation in Santa Teresa, again in São Paulo, or very close to São Paulo, and up in João Pessoa. João Pessoa is the easternmost city on the American continents, on the mainland of the American continents. In fact, I don't know if you all realize it, but Brazilian schools teach that there are only six continents. There are not seven, because America is one continent in their teaching. And so they would, in that situation, say that João Pessoa is the easternmost city on the American continent, being the one single continent. People down there also say that cats have seven lives, so that cat food that they sell here probably wouldn't have much of a market down there. And I don't know if you know it, but the Wright brothers did not invent the airplane. It was Santos Dumont who invented the airplane. He's a Brazilian. It was a Brazilian. And they make a pretty plausible argument, even though I went to high school close to Dayton, Ohio, which is Wright brothers' territory, but they make a pretty plausible argument for giving credit to Santos Dumont for that. He was so upset when he saw the way it was being used in First World War that he committed suicide. Seeing the use of the airplane just a few years after its invention. But there's a good group meeting up in João Pessoa. This picture is actually of one wing of the congregation. They meet in a garage and a patio of a house with a corner of the house in the middle. So whoever's speaking up front has to be up in the corner of that where he can see out both directions, but they can't see each other. The ones that are back in the different corners of those two wings of the group. In that same time period, the group that's now meeting in Jordanopolis had begun. That's in the São Paulo area itself. By 2005, a little bit further expansion, a new congregation in Cotia, which is about an hour from where we live, just outside of the city of São Paulo. Now, I want to give a little emphasis here. Forget about the picture for a moment and watch the map as we go from 2005 to 2008, and reminding you that my kids grew up and I started traveling more in late 2006 to try to get to more places and follow up on more contacts. In that next few years, 2006, 7, and 8, there were several new congregations that were begun in different places. A congregation in the state of Minas Gerais, which is the state just north of us, a very small group in the city of Ipatinga. Brasilia, the capital city of Brazil. Congregation there started with a 21-year-old fellow who took a dive into a swimming pool, cracked his head, and almost died, and started thinking about what would have happened if he had died. And that was what got Peterson to start studying the scriptures. By the time I met him, we'd already corresponded for some time. By the time I got up there and met him, one of the first things out of his mouth was to ask for help on his situation of his own salvation. And the next day he was baptized, continues to be faithful. Recently converted a woman that he worked with who was a young, very young widow, recently married her. There are now several others in the congregation there in Brasilia. It's a very active and thriving little congregation in the capital city of Brazil. During that time period also, there was a congregation began down in Porto Alegre. I did not have involvement with him initially. Gary Fisher was going down there more at that point, but I've been able to make several trips and to work with those brethren a number of times since that time. And up in Fortaleza, on the northeastern coast, I talked about the work in Fortaleza last time I was here. There have been about three congregations established in Fortaleza. At one point when I tried to add it all up, I figured about 60 people probably, maybe a little more, in those congregations. And all of this in that period between 2005 and 2008. Now, watch again the map. Forget the picture in the corner. Watch the map again. This is going to be 2008 to 2011. What we've seen in these last few years is the same kind of expansion. And what's been happening, just to give an idea, the contact in Manaus came because of somebody who moved from Fortaleza to Manaus. Fortaleza had started because of somebody who participated in a Bible study in Rio, and so on, that kind of thing just naturally branches out. The other thing that has had a great impact on this have been the website contacts. In Rio, we had tried public studies in Rio several times and had seen very little fruit until the last year and a half. There's now a congregation of about 10 people meeting in Rio. Everyone in that congregation was a website contact. I went over there first to study with a couple of couples, but then later, after they were converted and later others started to come and to get in touch with us, we would put them in touch with each other so they would study with them and follow up on that. And there's now a congregation of about 10 people. Got some real challenges, but they are showing some determination, and some of them made some very big sacrifices to serve the Lord, to give up things in their lives, and I'll touch on some of those sacrifices in a moment. But what we've been able to see in these last few years is more expansion. Somebody asked me last night when I was down in Hartsel, why so much empty area over here? Primary reason is that this is the least populous part of Brazil. I catch this area right through here. The part up here is the Amazon rainforest. Outside the state of Manaus, for example, has a little over 2 million people. I think 1.3 million of those are in the city of Manaus, the state of Amazonas, excuse me. And that's a huge state here, but almost all of the people concentrated here. These other states over here are what's referred to as the Pantanal. It's kind of a savanna and marshy area. A lot of wildlife, but not a lot of human population. And so there are some cities there, and we do hope to get into some of these areas. But so far, those have been some of the areas that we've not had as much opportunity, not as much contact. There aren't as many people, and there are not as many people using Internet. So we're not getting as many contacts from over in those parts of the country. But the Internet has been extremely effective in opening doors in these last few years, including of approximately 50 people baptized in the last year. I would guesstimate that about 40 of those, about 80%, were website contacts. That has turned out to be the way that we're getting to so many of the people that we teach. That includes a little congregation of five women up in Alagoas. It includes three congregations now in the state of Sergipe. That's where Carl Ballard has moved back to. Some of you may know Carl. He lived in Brazil for about 6.5 years, married a Brazilian, brought her back to the States for a few years, but then repented and moved back to Brazil with her. So he is now back with his family in Sergipe, working with three congregations up in that state, as well as helping in some other work in other places. These are some of the other brethren that he works with there in that area. Manaus, that I mentioned briefly, was a couple that moved from Fortaleza to Manaus that opened up contact for us there. At about the same time, another couple had begun a congregation there. They'd left a congregation that they disagreed with on several points, and it started doing a pretty good job of teaching their neighbors. So we were able to start to work together. There have been several conversions in Manaus, including this little guy, hardly showing up on the screen here, but he looks even smaller than he really is. It's just his head showing here. But Holmbergi was a Baptist preacher. First time he came to some of our Bible studies. And after about 10 days that we had studies over in different places over that period of time, he realized his need to obey the gospel and has continued to do quite well working with the congregation there, along with the other brethren there in Manaus. What I want to show now in this next one, trying to use a different symbol here, the little round smiley faces do not represent congregations. They represent another reality that we deal with frequently in Brazil. And that is situations where one person obeys the gospel, but we don't know of any other faithful Christians within hours and hours where that person lives. If you can imagine this kind of a situation, the easiest way I know to relate is to put it in these terms. Imagine if in all of the United States, leaving Alaska out of the picture, but all the 48 states that you all know here, there were five men supported to preach the gospel on a full-time basis. That is our situation in Brazil. We are dealing with a land area that large, two Americans and three Brazilians supported to preach the gospel in that area. And this is not an appeal for money. This involves manpower, not cash. Because I have never asked for American churches to support Brazilian preachers and don't intend to. I encourage Brazilian churches to support Brazilian preachers. And I'm hoping that we will see more and more men develop, but it takes time. It takes time to get men to that point and to get churches to the point of assuming that kind of responsibility. But what that means is it's just flatly impossible. And even though it's not all dependent on preachers, there are other Christians who do make trips and help extensively in different ones of these different places. But it's still such a huge country with maybe about 25 congregations that we're working with scattered throughout the country. There are a lot of work to be done yet. That's not even average of one congregation per state when you think of it in those terms. And when you remember that a lot of those groups are concentrated in just a couple of states, it means a lot of areas where there's still work to be done. And many people are in those situations being rather isolated. I want to tell you about one of these isolated Christians. This smiley face right here in the northern part of Bahia represents a fellow named Romulo. Romulus would be the closest thing in English. Romulo started corresponding with me a few months ago. And when I saw where he lived and saw what his situation was and looked at my own travel schedule and knew that I wasn't going to get close to him for a while, I passed that correspondence on to Gerson, who preaches in Jequié in the southern part of the same state. And again, we're talking about a very large state. I'm guessing maybe three times the size of Alabama or so, that state that we're looking at. Gerson started corresponding with Romulo and was able finally to arrange to make a visit to where Romulo lives. To do that, Gerson went several hours by bus, the last couple of hours on dirt roads, to get to the little isolated village up in the northern part of Bahia where Romulo lives. When he got there, Romulo had already studied on his own a great deal. He's in a little village where, as far as I know, the only church that meets there is a Catholic church, and he already realized problems with their teaching. When Romulo was 3 years old, one of his parents died, and when he was 12, the other died. He's being raised by an aunt. He's 15 years old. And this is how Romulo has learned the scriptures. He would scrape up enough coins to go to what you'd think of as a cyber cafe, where he probably pays about 75 cents an hour to use the internet. He'd scrape up enough coins to go and get on the internet and had found our website. We'd get on there and read articles. He didn't have money, additional money, to print things out. And at that point, hadn't received our material in printed form. So he would take a notebook with him, and he would write down all the scripture references in the articles he was reading and go back home and study that. No support from his aunt, no church around there that could help him, studying the Bible that way. By the time Gerson got there, Gerson was very impressed with the knowledge that this 15-year-old displayed. And the same day that he got there and met him, after they studied together for a while, Gerson baptized at home. When he sent me the email about that, it kind of got to me. To imagine that kind of determination of a 15-year-old who wants to know the Lord and wants to serve the Lord. He's kind of become for me a hero image of thinking of Hebrews 11:6, those who diligently seek him. Because that strikes me as diligently seeking. I don't know how the Lord is going to help Homolu. I am hopeful that brethren from the southern part of Bahia will get up there, and the brethren from over in Sergipe will be able to get over there and give him some help. I don't know what's going to work out to be the best way to help Homolu. We're going to provide him with all the material we can provide, and we're going to try to get him in touch with brethren as best we can. But I'm impressed by the attitude of a young man with that kind of dedication. I know so many 15-year-olds who think about everything but spending all of their money to study the Bible. But that's basically what Homolu has been doing. And I think a tremendous example. And there are other people in other places in similar situations, hours and hours away from other groups that we know about that we could put them in touch with. What does the gospel do? It does the same thing in Brazil that it does in Athens, Alabama. The gospel transforms lives and makes radical changes in the lives of people. Sometimes it means putting marriages back together. The fellow that I showed that was on the rooftop of his house with about 40 people there in that Bible study, first time he came to a study, he knew nothing about the Bible, came because his sister invited him. His sister's a member of a denomination. She thinks she's just fine the way she is. She came because she was invited by an insurance salesman who at the time was serving the Lord and has since totally abandoned the faith. When Van der Lee came to that first study, he was recovering from a hangover. His marriage was on the rocks because of his drinking. But after the first day that he participated in a Bible study, he said he never put another drop of alcohol in his mouth. A couple of months later, he and his wife were both baptized. Their marriage is now on very solid footing. They've had another child since that time. And every time I go to Manaus, I stay at their house. And he has become one of our most effective personal workers, has made trips at his own expense to several other states to help in studies that we've been doing there, gets out on the street and hands out. He's got a big infectious smile, just gets out on the street and hands out flyers to everybody he sees. Has been a tremendous worker. I'd kind of like to have a Van der Lee in every town in the country. We'd get more done if we had somebody like that everywhere we had. But he was about to lose it all before he found the truth of the gospel. Sometimes it's the other way around. Illicit marriages that are ended. There's a brother in Rio who had already been married. The woman that he was with had already been married. As he studied the gospel, he understood that they were not living according to God's will, and that in order for him to obey the gospel, he would have to separate from her. He did that and is serving the Lord now with the brethren in Rio. Many times it means putting businesses in order, putting taxes in order. I know one brother who, before he was converted, was a very effective businessman, started from a shoestring and was able over a period of maybe 15 years or so to amass a small fortune in businesses, real estate, and so on. But as about 90% of Brazilians do, he was evading his taxes on that. And the reason 90% of Brazilians evade taxes is because the taxes are outrageous. And so if a person doesn't have conviction that he has an obligation to pay, he'll look for a way not to pay. About 50% of everything we earn goes to the government in Brazil. 18% sales tax, 27% income tax, 4% vehicle tax, plus property taxes, plus gasoline taxes, a few other things they throw in. So people evade taxes, and that's what this man had done. But when you do report your taxes in Brazil, you report not only your income, you also report your property. So when he converted, and now he realizes he must report his taxes, the first thing the government's going to ask when the equivalent of the IRS calls them in for an audit, how did you get all this real estate if you didn't have any income? Because you weren't reporting your income for several years. And he knows that's coming. He's waiting. They're very slow about getting around to the audits, but he knows it's coming. And we've talked about it. And I've suggested to him that even though an accountant will probably try to find ways for him to hide all that, that he just go in when he's called into the audit, tell him the truth. I wasn't a Christian. I am now. I wasn't paying my taxes, but I am declaring them now. Help me figure out what I've got to do to straighten this out, and I will pay it. And he's ready to sell off properties in order to be able to pay the tax bill. And that's all inevitably what's going to happen. Sometimes that's what it means. Sometimes it means closing businesses. There was a woman converted last year in Rio who ran a dance studio teaching choreography and teaching young ladies sensual dances. She's a Christian now. She understands she can't do that, so she closed the school. It was apparently a pretty simple decision for her once she decided to serve the Lord. Sometimes it means giving up positions in churches. Sometimes it means, not sometimes, almost always, it means learning to dress differently. Brazil has a real problem with indecency. The United States does too. Last time I was here in the wintertime, it was better. And it's warm weather now. Brazil has a problem with that. And so as people live in a culture in which they think it's normal to walk around with very little clothing, when they become Christians, they have to put their clothes on. Sometimes it takes some effort to get them to understand that, but that's a part of what we deal with frequently. And always, if we're going to serve the Lord, we're going to have to learn to stand alone. Real briefly, some of the challenges that we're facing. Danger, stagnation, and frustration. We've been there almost 19 years. In a sense, we're coming into a second generation in this work. And that involves some challenges in that respect. We are constantly encouraging Brazilians to have a greater commitment financially and supporting Brazilian preachers to be able to get more work accomplished. And the increasing prosperity in Brazil. Brazilians, on average, are much better off financially than they were 18 years ago. That presents its own challenges. People can easily say, well, why do I need God for if I've got this? And to not realize that the need they have of God is not for material things, never was, but a much greater need than that. And there's so many reasons that we have to be thankful. We are privileged, blessed to work in a place where there are many people receptive to the gospel. I hear brethren in this country often bemoaning the difficulty of finding people to teach. I never wake up in the morning wondering if I can find somebody to teach. The only question I have is which one gets priority, because there are always, always more opportunities than we can possibly get to. I'm thankful for zealous Brazilian brethren like Vanderlei that I mentioned earlier and others who are dedicating themselves to getting the gospel spread. I'm thankful for the faithful support of brethren back here. Best we could figure it out talking before the services here. I think the congregation here has been helping in my support for about 17 years now. I was at another congregation recently that has been helping in my support for 22 years. Been helping now for 27 years, even before we left the United States. And another one a few weeks ago that has sent a check every month for 31 years, helping us work in Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, and now in Brazil. That's not just a check in the mail, folks. That's a relationship of brethren who are sharing in the work. What's being done in Brazil is because God is working. God is allowing us to have a part in that, and he's allowing you to have a part in that. We are working together to try to serve him, and he continues to give the increase, and we need to praise him and thank him for that. And I thank him for you and for your faithful part in that work. Questions, you're welcome to talk to me afterwards. Anybody have any questions about any of this, I'd be happy to talk, and Benita has all the answers as well. Thank you.